After a lifetime of researching the dynamic and enigmatic world of light entertainment, I've decided to ditch my notebook and meet the people who inspire me. What makes them the people they are? How do they feel about the show business landscape in which they find themselves? And in a world where anyone can be a star, is there still a need for performers who have universal appeal? Come with me on a journey of discovery as I get a unique insight into Britain's favourite stars with a little help from my glamorous assistants. Yeah, well, I say glamorous, more like hazardous. And of course, we'll have a bit of fun along the way.
Celebrated television and theatre actor Clive Mantle first came to the public attention playing Dr. Mike Barrett in the long-running BBC medical drama Casualty. After securing several minor roles in other Hollywood films such as White Hunter Blackheart and Alien 3, Mantle turned his attention to the stage, appearing in such productions as Coming Clean, A Streetcar Named Desire, and Educating Rita. In 2010, he was cast as Tommy Cooper for the stage biopic Just Like That, before reprising the role of Mike Barrett in the hospital drama Holby City. I caught up with the versatile actor to talk doctors, nurses, and the secret of good comedy. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Clive Mantle.
What's your book about?
My book is set in the present day and in 1989 in Nepal. It's a present given to a 13-year-old boy called Freddie Malone by his quite eccentric Irish uncle, Uncle Patrick, who gives him a map of the world for his 13th birthday. And it's a very mystical, as if it's sort of been bought from a faraway market in sort of Marrakesh. It sort of smells musty, and it's amazing colours and detail on the map. And up it goes on Freddie's bedroom wall. And that night he magically disappears in through the map, in through a time tunnel, a vortex which takes him past all the periods of history. They're all up on the side of the vortex, like a big tube station with the adverts on either side. And he ends up in Nepal in 1989. He's absolutely doesn't understand why he's there, but he's... He's been called there to do something and to help. Wow. And during the course of the book, he solves mysteries, he defeats baddies, he tracks down ancient lost treasure and mixes in with real historical characters. Doesn't actually affect the way history turns out, but he's there, he witnesses history in the making. It's a nice device whereby he can... relate what it's like in Everest and in that surrounding region. It's a pretty good device for being able to send Freddie to any place and any time in history. And book two, which I'm writing at the moment, he's in ancient Egypt, right up his neck in intrigue and adventure, and with King Tutankhamun. So he's having a wonderful time at the moment in my imagination and on the page, cavorting around ancient Egypt. And book three, which I tackle next, is going to be in Pepys's London. So the Great Fire, the Great Plague, and then the Great Fire of London, 1665 and 1666. So you can see I can sort of zip about all over the place and place Freddie wherever I like. I've been doing a lot of schools talks, and I always ask them at the end where they want me to send Freddie, and half of them always say to space. You know, they always want him to go exploring in the future. So I shall have to do that at some stage. I've got the first five sort of mapped.
Sounds like a movie kind of trio waiting to happen.
It's funny you should say that, because in the spring, a great friend of mine, Jason Connery, and I are going to sit down and do the screenplay for the first one.
Oh, wow.
It's tricky with when your leading man and leading ladies are 13-year-olds. They change so quickly, you know, at that age.
Yeah, of course.
It would probably be the case of trying to do three films at once while they're still,
at the same age.
Shoot up too much and become adults, you know.
Brilliant. Well, it sounds all very, very busy and promising.
Yeah, it's very exciting. And after years and years and years of theatre and film and television and radio, which I've loved doing, it's quite nice at the elderly age I am now to be able to stay at home for a bit and write. You know, it's the glamour of touring about the country and doing great big long theatre tours and being away from home and the ones you love has long lost its appeal, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I'm sure it's nice to be home and, like you say, doing something very different to what you're used to.
Well, that's right, and something which I'm in control of. Very, very, very seldom in acting are you in control of your own destiny. You're always waiting for someone else to offer you a job. You're always, once you've done the job, you're always at the mercy of the editor, if you like. You know, you can do the best work in the world, but if it's not included in the final edit, you're stuffed, really.
Yeah, so I can imagine that's frustrating as well.
Yeah, so at least writing a book, you know, I have to answer questions to my publishers, but, you know, if I've got a good enough argument, they'll go, sure, that's great.
We'll get to your major accomplishments in a second, but one of the striking things about your early career was that you attended RADA between 1978 and 1980. Why do you think RADA has been so instrumental to careers for some of Britain's best-loved actors?
RADA's had an amazing reputation for decades now, and it comes really from the title, and I think, you know, it seemed very prestigious, so I think the best candidates always applied to get into RADA, and they sort of, for a long time, took the cream of the crop, which built its reputation. I don't think that's necessarily the case anymore. It's a wonderful drama school still, but there's other drama schools like Lambda and Bristol Vic. You know, they're equally as good, I presume. It's a long time since I left, so I'm not the world's expert, but it was certainly a wonderful training ground for me. My contemporaries in my year were a very, very successful stage actor called Richard McCabe and, of course, Mark Rylance. They were both in my term at RADA, so they were my contemporaries. I learned from them day in, day out for 3 years, as well as the teachers. It's an amazing academy. For a long time, it held all the rights to the George Bernard Shaw estate, especially Pygmalion and therefore My Fair Lady, all the rights and all the residuals from that for 50 years after Bernard Shaw's death went to RADA, which meant it was on a sound financial footing. That's long since disappeared, and obviously, it stands or falls on its own merits now. But that meant it was, wasn't struggling so much for funding in its early years, and therefore had a very secure and lovely base, and a lovely building, lovely theatres. You know, it was a great environment to work in, and a great environment to learn.
Excellent. Okay, what some people may not know is that you've been involved in some iconic films such as Alien 3. Yeah. How did that come about?
Alien 3 was a remarkable stroke of luck, really. When I was at drama school, I played a character called Dad in a wonderful play called East by Stephen Burkoff, and I had my head shaved completely. I just thought, well, this is too good an opportunity to miss. And I got one of my pals in my term to quickly take a few shots of me with a bald head in case it ever came in useful for casting purposes in later years. Cut to, I don't know, 10, however many years later it was, my agent had always had this bald photo ready to spring on someone if they needed to see what I looked like with a shaved head. And lo and behold, 20th Century Fox were looking for a whole load of bald actors to play these prisoners on the asteroid hurtling through space. And the story goes that David Fincher, the amazing David Fincher, whose first major feature film it was, he took one look at my photo and said, get me 20 more of those. So he pinned my picture up on the board, and that was the in the casting suite or wherever it was, and said, this is the sort of ugly so-and-so that I want in the film. So, I mean, how fortuitous is that? A picture taken on off chance by a mate, just on the off chance, years and years later, leads to being in Alien 3. So a fantastic, fantastic story, really.
That's great. Okay, as an actor, you've been in just about every medium. And in theatre, you were in the stage version of Educating Rita. Yeah. How do you go about making such an iconic part your own?
Well, it's very difficult when, there's been a lot of actors who've played the part before. It's not quite as bad as playing Hamlet, where, virtually every actor in the country has had a go at that. but a lot of people have played Frank in Educating Rita. And you learn from what you've seen. I mean, You can't do what Michael Caine did, because that was on film, and you can't do that in the theatre, or people would think you were asleep. A film is in close up, and you can detect nuance in the eyes. You don't have to. There's no grand gestures. There's no histrionics. Whereas on stage, you've got to employ your whole body, your whole voice, everything to get your point across and to get the point of the character and the point of the story, the point of the script across. So it's a totally different set of problems. And I'm trained for a stage, so it feels a totally natural environment for me, whereas maybe film and television, you're sort of lucky to pick up what you learn as you struggle on in a career in this country in film and television. But stage is very, I feel very much at home there. Yes, you don't want to be, it's not as though I want to be the best, but you certainly don't want to be the worst, put it that way. You want to do yourself, you want to do your play, and you want to do your your colleagues in the cast, you want to do them justice and do the piece justice. And to be honest, you want to give the audience their money's worth. That's the prime requisite of an actor in a play, is to, people have been good enough to put their hand in their pocket to turn up to a theatre, and it's your job to entertain them and give them their money's worth. So that's basically what I'm concentrating on when I'm in a play.
Excellent. Okay, I suppose your first real television break came in 1986 when you were cast as Mike Barrett in the serial drama Casualty. What were your first impressions of the show?
I was in series 2 as a relative of somebody who was ill in the department. As a guest part for that episode. And then years later, the Casualty's got a 3-year rule. You're not allowed back into Casualty until after 3 years, until sort of people have forgotten that you played something else. Fortuitously, an actor called Nigel Avaient was leaving the series, and they wanted a complete contrast to his character. I think he'd been quite a troubled and quite an uptight sort of character in the series. I can't say I remember it exactly, but they wanted a more relaxed, genial, easygoing, sort of bloke. Anyway, I turned up at the audition, and I lived near Bristol, where it's made, and they literally they didn't ask me to read or act or do anything like that at this audition. They just said, "So tell us about your life. Where do you live?" And I told them, and they said, "Well, it's about half an hour drive every morning. If this came off, it'd be the best job I could ever have. I could live at home and lead a normal life and have a lovely job on the telly." And literally, we chatted for 15 or 20 minutes about what a convenient job it would be for me. Didn't hear anything more for a couple of days, and then they said I got the job. So,
you know,
it's an amazing, again, an amazing, wonderful stroke of luck. Up to that point, I'd just played thugs, really. Thugs of all types in all sorts of things, with all just sorts of different accents. And or I'd been just used as the lummox in the background who punches people or gets punched. So this was the first real constructive, educated, clever man that I'd certainly played in on telly. And you know, because things are so stereotyped, pigeonholed. If you're 6'5" and a half, then you're a baddie or a thug. You know, there's no, you know, you don't get 6'5" and a half doctors on television.
Yeah.
Or didn't until I came along. So you know, it was a great mold breaker for me.
And sounded perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, in terms of television drama, you are unique in that you've played the same character in two serial drama shows. How did it feel resurrecting Mike Barrett in Holby City in 1999?
Yeah, very different. I'd gone off and I'd done other things. I'd done tours of Mice and Men, which is my favourite play. I'd gone off and done The Vicar of Dibley, things like that. But they came to me with the return of Mike Barrett, and I missed him. I really did. I missed him. I missed the regular income, and they promised me, which was my desire, that the character would be as good as he was in Casualty. He would be. They wouldn't water him down. They wouldn't ask. I asked that they didn't ask him to do impossible things. I just wanted to play a real doctor in a real situation, and represent the amazing work that the surgeons and the consultants and the doctors do every day up and down the length and breadth of the country in the NHS. So that's what I was concerned with.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid I didn't really enjoy Holby City. I enjoyed my scenes with George Irving. We had a lovely sparring relationship. He was playing the heart surgeon, mayor, and a very different human being from Dr. Mike Barrett. So, that was all very interesting to play. But the rest of it was really about which nurse you were going to try and kiss behind which pillow that week, and I really didn't have any interest in that at all. It also seemed slightly to be about the storylines. We only seemed to sort of treat relatives of the people who worked in the department. I know they got to crowbar some of that in, but I mean, I just thought this is the only hospital in the country where the general public aren't getting a look in. I didn't enjoy it.
It didn't seem as real as Casualty then. It was.
No, it didn't. I mean, at least when we did Casualty, certainly at the start, we were still talking about the state of the health service, the pressures on the health service, the cuts, the restrictions, the pressure, the impossibility of being able to look after everybody, and the amazing job that the NHS do. And I didn't think Holby was run at that time. I don't watch it now, so I don't know if it's changed. Yeah. I didn't think Holby was run on those sort of lines.
That's fair enough. Do you think that's down to the director in production?
Well, really, it comes in terms of vogue for television, which has changed dramatically over the long number of years I've been involved in. People call it dumbing down. I mean, there's a million ways of explaining it, but just.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a question of trends changing. It's a question of the audience demanding faster, more furious, more maybe less in-depth storylines. In-depth, you can't let a character evolve over weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. You know, I watch some dramas now, and I can tell you in the first opening two or three scenes, everything that's set up. I can tell you who's going to do what to who's going to end up married to who, who's going to have a fight with who, who's going to do somebody wrong, who's going to betray someone, who's going to fall in love with someone who doesn't fall in love with them. It's all written on the faces and in the dialogue of the first scenes these people play. Then it's just a very, you know, and I can guarantee you I don't ever watch episode 2 or 3 of anything like that. Nothing is left to the audience's imagination anymore. You know, in cinema, we just immerse ourselves in the story in a different world, in a different realm. Not everything is spelled out in the first opening scene. Things are left to gradually evolve, and you know, appealing to the intelligence of the audience. Now the demand for, there's so many channels,
yeah,
there's so much demand for attention that everything's reduced to immediacy, to sensationalism, to whatever. There's room for that, but you know, there's also room for considered and studied and clever and witty forms of drama as well, and comedy. Anyway, that's just an old idiot talking, but it's just symptomatic of the way things have changed. I think not for the better, but a lot of other people will say, of course, it's for the better.
Do you think that's why TV dramas now are so short? As in, there's only six episodes a series, rather than Holby and Casualty that have been around for decades.
Yeah.
Do you think that the drama scene now has got so short-winded they've put it into these tiny little segments?
Yes, or it could well be that the things are so fast-moving, so cartoon-like, if you like, almost like a strip cartoon flashing, yeah, before your eyes. There's partly that, and also partly maybe it's a vogue for just dealing with one simple storyline and seeing that through. You know, there's nothing more wonderful than a multi-layered drama where, you know, you've got an A storyline, a B storyline, a C storyline, and
yeah,
at times they interweave with each other. Characters from one, you know, side of the story emerge suddenly in another side of the story, and I mean, think of Breaking Bad and think the complexity of series like that.
Yeah.
The Sopranos, all these things are just so delicious in their complexity.
Yeah.
That, you know, they stand head and shoulders above you know, just the simple one strand storyline. TV or something like that. Yeah,
brilliant. Okay, sorry, getting away from drama, you've dabbled in comedy, so let's deal with the positive ones first. You were involved in one of the most iconic sitcom scenes of the last 30 years in the Vicar of Dibley's puddle scene.
Yeah.
Can you just take us through the process of filming that?
Well, it was, you know, I mean, we knew it was funny as we were filming it, and it was funny written on the page, it was funny in the preparation, it was certainly funny in the performance and capturing it, and of course it took on this whole other life when it was broadcast. It became Britain's funniest comedy moment or something, or one of them, one of the top 2 or 3. Yeah, it's an absolute privilege to have been involved in it. I have to say that obviously on the day people were concerned about Dawn's safety and comfort. You know, weren't actually sort of running around saying, "Are you all right, Clive?" You know, because all our efforts were making sure that Dawn, you know, didn't freeze to death. They warmed the water in the puddle. They gave her a wetsuit to wear under her costume. I think it was a fairly cold, wintry day, as I remember.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I suddenly, we rehearsed without her going in, obviously. And I suddenly realized, because we'd never gone to the point of her jumping in, I suddenly, just as they called for action, And I suddenly realised that I hadn't at all thought about what my reaction would be as she went into the puddle. So as she went in, I literally just put my hands up to my head and went, "Oh no!" And luckily, I mean, it served as the as a good enough reaction to what she'd done. But you know, it's just one of those things that I remember it for being slightly underprepared on the reaction front, and the rest of the country remembers it as one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Yeah, it certainly was. Certainly was. Okay, now for the difficult one. Mm-hmm. Why do you think your 97 sitcom, Bloomin' Marvelous, wasn't received very well by TV critics?
Well, you know, there's no doubt about it. You couldn't have got a better actress in the country than Sarah Lancashire to play opposite. And the two of us sparred wonderfully well together, got on terribly well together. And it should have been a recipe for absolute success. We were both very, very, we were rolling high. She'd just come out of Coronation Street. I'd just come out of Casualty.
Yeah.
You know, in all intents and purposes, it was a marriage made in heaven. But sadly, the scripts weren't laugh out loud funny. They were gentle. They were a comedy of manners, not of, you know, it wasn't like Bottom, it wasn't like The Young Ones, it wasn't Broad, it should not have been filmed in front of a studio audience, that first series. We should have been on location. There was just, the vogue was just starting for people doing slightly less obvious comedy, gently, on location, single camera, and letting the comedy unfold, letting people get to know the characters and their behaviours, and then growing to love them in that way. The subject matter, the script, just wasn't studio audience laugh out loud funny, ha ha. You know, it wasn't Mrs. Brown's Boys. It wasn't that sort of immediate or obvious. It needed far more gently handling. And They offered us that for the second series. They said, okay, we realised it shouldn't have been done in front of a studio audience. This is what we've been saying all along.
Yeah.
Let's do it on location. So, but Sarah had had enough by then. She said, no, you know, it's gone wrong once. We can't risk it going wrong again. That would be ridiculous. So that was it. I was offered to carry on with the recast with someone else, but I thought what's the audience going to make of this? It's just like doing a failed science experiment in front of their eyes, you know. And what if that goes wrong, you know? So it was far better probably that we left it alone. Which is a great shame, because I, as I say, Sarah and I gotten terribly well. We worked together really well. I don't think the scripts were TV friendly for that format.
Yeah.
And probably made us try too hard to make them work. So our performances were too exaggerated, maybe, trying to make this gentle comedy fit into a more raucous comedy format. I think
it's a shame. It's a shame because you two got on so well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, and you never get the next chance. You know, it's not like Terry Scott and June Whitfield or whoever it is who go from series and series and series together. Not Spencer Tracy and Catherine Hepburn. I wouldn't put us in that bracket. But we certainly had a great comic potential together, which was sadly cut short, because but we tried our hardest. I can promise you that we kept on at it, and when the first episodes were going out, as we were still making the end episodes, so you know, we battled away. You know, we didn't just give up. We were still trying to pull it round, but to no avail, I'm afraid.
Okay, staying with comedy, in 2010, you replaced Jerome Flynn for the Tommy Cooper stage biopic, yep. Just Like That.
That's right.
What did you learn about the great man from doing this?
Well, obviously, if you're tackling a legend, which is what Tommy Cooper was and still is, you've got to delve as far into it, warts and all, as you can. It's not only about learning how to do the Margate routine or the bottle and glass routine or the doctor jokes or anything like that. It's about learning about the man, learning about the psyche of the man, learning about his background, where he's from, who he's married to, what his children are like, what his mistress was like, whether he bought a drink, you just immerse yourself in his life. And luckily, we had John Fisher at hand, who was his last producer on television, who'd written a wonderful book. I'm staring at it now on my shelf in my study. And a wonderful, wonderful book about Tommy, which was a sort of Bible. And then I talked to a lot of people who'd worked with him, who knew him, people like Paul Daniels and many others gave me vital, vital information about him. And not all of it flattering by any means whatsoever. I mean, he was not an easy man to get along with off stage, but yet on stage he was this absolutely consummate and brilliant performer who largely did the same material for his entire career. I mean, yes, he did some sketches which I tend to sort of ignore on his television show because they were I don't think they were that brilliant. Some of them were very funny, but by and large they weren't his masterwork. But his masterwork was his number one cabaret act and the floating material that was around that. So it's all about an hour and a half, 2 hours worth of material that is genuinely brilliant. And so I learnt those routines. I must have watched the videos and the DVDs 80, 90 times and practiced them. I had the legendary Jeffrey Durham, the great Soprendo magician, teaching me all the magic. And you just build everything up. You build the physical side of the man, the vocal side of the man, the magical side of the man, the comedic side of the man, the personal life of the man. You try his mannerisms, the way he moves, his arms, you try and link all these disparate bits and pieces together, a bit like Frankenstein, and stick them on one at a time onto your central core. And then you try and lose Clive Mantle in the mix and become Tommy Cooper.
Yeah.
You just try and get as much of the man up there on stage as you possibly can. And people were flattering enough to say that at times, they forgot it was me, and for moments here and there, it was as if Tommy was up there. So that's great. That's really fantastic.
That's really great.
Yeah.
Okay. Looking back at your career, what is your proudest achievement?
I think of Mice and Men on stage, which is certainly the greatest play I've ever been in, and. I count a great play as not only an intellectual exercise, but an emotional exercise. I'm far more happy with the sort of American dramas of Miller and Tennessee Williams and John Steinbeck, which hit the audience in the solar plexus as they sat in the theater. There's an emotional intelligence, an intelligence of a comedy and a situation which affects the audience as they're sitting there. I don't mind cerebral dramas where people go away and 2 days later they say, oh, that's what that play was about. But I will far rather affect people there in the moment, in the theatre, move them, make them laugh, make them cry there and then, which I think still lasts within many years. I mean, I get so many letters still or Facebook messages or whatever from people who saw of Mice and Men at the Mermaid in 1984, I think, and 84-85, who say I saw that, and you know, I'll never forget it, and that is an amazing compliment. So the biggest test I probably had, other than Tommy, probably Tommy Cooper. So early, and it gave me such a massive lift early on in my career, which was amazing. But more than that, it is the most amazing piece of work. It's the most finely structured play that I think I've ever appeared in. Wonderful, wonderful piece.
That's great. Okay, last one. And what's next for Clive Mantle?
Well, busy writing book two. I'm deep in the bowels of Tutankhamun's tomb as we speak.
Yep.
Reviewing what I did yesterday and planning on this afternoon with some more. Okay. I love it. It's a real pleasure. I mean, I know the characters. You know, they're affected by things like bullying and you know, being strangers in a foreign land. Their Irish family living in England, and some of our modern present day phobias and prejudices. Nice to sort of get to an audience early on at eight plus and sort of start dispelling some of these myths and start, you know, kids don't know there's any difference between skin color. They just know whether they're mates or not, you know, at that age.
Yeah.
It's only the prejudice of age and politics that cause strife and division. So it's nice to reinforce at an early age what a wonderful place this world could be if only we all treated each other a little more gently.
Yeah.
And also then, you know, being able to whisk Freddie and subsequently Connor, his best mate, who's a slightly overweight chap who gets bullied a lot, and their new pal Ruby, how they, you know, they're going to end up in all sorts of fun and scrapes, you know, throughout history. So, I mean, that's a big enough world for me to spend many years in. I feel like I'm in a different place every day. You do your research. You know, the research I've done on Egypt is just these places and that civilization is just amazing. And you know, to have I know I haven't been paid for it yet, but when I sell some of the books, it'll, you know, to be paid for doing this sort of work is quite literally a privilege, really.
That's brilliant. No, thank you very, very much for that.
That's all right.
And for your time. It's been a fantastic pleasure.
Thank you very much to our guests for being the subject to another Beyond the Title interview. If you like this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time for another Beyond the Title interview.